Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to The Right Stuff with R.J. Jeffries. I'm your host, Jeff. The Right Stuff with R.J. Jeffries is a live radio interview show focused primarily on the lead players in the arts and letters who are authors, poets, writers, book publishers, and those who create works of art in film, fine art, music, and other creative disciplines. For more info about The Right Stuff with R.J. Jeffries and their other excellent hosts and broadcasts, please visit the World of Ink Network at www.worldofinknetwork.com. My fascinating guest this evening is Ami Kay. Ami serves as publisher of Glass Liar Press and is also the principal owner and managing editor of Pyrene's Fountain, a poetry journal. Ami edited and published Sunrise from Blue Thunder in response to the Japan 2011 disasters. More recently, she co-edited First Water, Best of Pyrene's Fountain. Her poems, reviews, and articles have appeared in various journals and anthologies. Kay's work was nominated for the James B. Baker Award and received an honorable mention in the 2013 Tefera Journal Writing Contest. She's the author of What Hands Can Hold and has also interviewed various literary personalities.
Welcome, Ami, to my show. It is such a pleasure to have you here and an honor. And how are you this evening?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on your show, Jeff. I have a deep admiration for what you do, and it's my pleasure and privilege to be here. I'd also like to thank the lovely Cindy Hockman, editor-in-chief of First Literary Review East, for her glowing words on your Facebook event introduction to this evening. And, of course, I'm thrilled to be here to chat with you and Melissa, and I have some fun time talking about books and publishing.
Well, I'm so looking forward to it. And yes, Melissa Studdard, who's also a host herself for Tefera Talk for the Tefera Journal, where I'm also honored to be an associate editor, is joining us tonight doing the producing in the background. So thank you for that, Melissa.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so delighted to be here and get to talk to you again and talk to Ami for the first time.
Yes, this was just a very lovely bonus for me.
Wonderful. It's just wonderful. I'd like to begin by asking you to give me and give our listeners a brief historical perspective on Glass Liar Press and Pyrene's Fountain and your role there and duties as publisher and managing editor.
Sure. So Glass Liar Press, we actually just started this press 1 year ago, and we spent most of last year just setting it up. There were a lot of business, concerns we had to take care of, the legalities, registration, you know, those kind of nitty-gritties. And it took a good, I would say, 6 months just getting that cart set up. And then, of course, we put out a call for submissions, and Mark McKay, our editor-in-chief in Scotland, started reading submissions, and to our surprise and great pleasure, we received some really, really good submissions. So towards the end of the year, we started putting some of the books together. Glass Liar Press is a small independent press, and we have a fairly small team of maybe 8 to 9 staff members. I am the publisher, so I basically take care of most of the production work. Mark and his crew take care of submissions. And then we have a design, layout, and art team that works on the covers and the layout inside, the interior of the book, with the fonts and the styles and all that kind of thing. And Pyrene's Fountain is a journal that we started about more than 6 years back. the same team worked on Pyrene Fountain, which has been an online poetry journal. And we just had such a great time with that. We got wonderful submissions. We enjoyed all the work from our poets. And, you know, we had reviews, interviews, features. We had such a great time that it gave us the impetus to go ahead and start Blackfire Press.
That's wonderful. You really have an exceptional staff, and I want to say that your art department is phenomenal.
Thank you.
The cover artwork that's done for the journal and for also Glass Lyre is just outstanding. It melds the content. It's a wonderful symbiosis. I mean, if you look at the cover, it gives you a great indicator of what you're going to see inside. It's a win-win. They're both wonderful. So yeah, a wonderful art staff. So what, you know, bring me to a day in the life of your staff and you. Working on the journal and the publication.
Yes, we spend pretty much, you know, everyone has a different department, so it's kind of decentralized in that sense that everyone gets part of the project. So if we're working on a book, you know, say Steve and Catherine will be working on the layout, so they'll probably contact the author and say, hey, here are three sample fonts for your book, which is something that I think is, we started this because we wanted each author to feel that their book is not a product. It's a masterpiece of art. And we want all our authors to feel involved and like they have some kind of involvement in the way the book is going to come out and has a more personalized and customized feel. And we want the interior of the book to reflect the contents of the book to some extent, just as we want the cover to do that. And so we have the author will give us the manuscript, and then the manuscript goes through all the proofreading. Mark and I look at it carefully thinking, well, does this poem belong in the beginning? Should it be in the middle? You know, kind of looking at the ordering and how the poems kind of speak to each other, how are they falling on the page. So we look at all those different kind of things, and then we have several meetings to discuss what should we have on the cover. Should we do something quite obvious? Should we do something very subtle? And we do want that all our books look different, so that each one has a very distinct personality, if you will. And then since you were asking about the journal, it's a similar kind of a process, but a different way. In a journal, you're taking a lot of individual poems and putting them together. In a book, you're just working with one author, and you're focusing all your attention on that book. Then when you're done with that book, then you start another one. In the journal, you're working simultaneously with all the different authors and putting an issue together. And that's sometimes a little challenging because you get so many different ideas, so many different types of poems, but that's also something that is is one of our special things at Pyrene Fountain, that we want to welcome difference. We want to welcome diversity as much as possible because we want it to be a place where we all kind of come together, learn from each other, inspire each other, and be inspired by each other, regardless of the school or the style or the genre or anything like that. It's a kind of place of togetherness. And that's what our vision has always been for Pyrene Fountain.
How unique. What a wonderful model. Ami, who makes the ultimate decision on what will be published? Who ultimately is the final word?
You know, Mark and I do that together for Glasslyre Press. He actually is a very selective editor. I would say far more selective than I am. I might say yes to a couple of manuscripts that he might say, well, you know, this one doesn't quite do this, or this one, you know, lacks this, or this one should have this. So he's a little bit more selective, and that's why I trust him implicitly in that he will choose the best of what is submitted. And by best, I don't mean it for what we need. When you have a press, you are looking at a catalog of titles. It's not that this is the best book or one poet is better than the other as such. It's more that in a catalog, we want to be able to have different pieces of work that all work, you know, that are all together in our catalog. So you could have, say, one book that is that has a certain subject, and then a different book of a different kind, and a third book that has a different style of writing, so that you have a nice variety. You don't want everything to be the same. So Mark will kind of look at that, and then the two of us together discuss it at the end, after he's made his recommendations. He might make four recommendations, saying, okay, these are the four that I think I think that Glasslar should publish. And then we'll sit down and we'll say, okay, we'll take this one, but the third one is too similar to the one we just published. So maybe we'll put this on the back burner, you know, that kind of a process. In Pyrene's Fountain, the submissions editor, Elizabeth Nichols, and I, we both decide, you know, sort of pick what goes into the journal.
What would you say? That's a wonderful process, and it's always good to have a second pair of eyes there with you, and someone to say, well, this is my perspective, and well, this is how I see that. But is this sort of universally, what would you say would be sort of the universal, thematically universal about what you want to publish? Is there, can you sort of put it into a phrase or a few words, what it's really about, what you're trying to convey, what do you want the reader to see and feel through your publications and your books?
You know what? I've always felt like the Glasslar vision, our vision, was always to connect the world through language, through beautiful language, poetry, short stories, fiction. To me, it's all about expressing what's inside of us. And I think to be part of that, to be part of bringing that out into the world, to be part of that birthing process, is a tremendous, tremendous privilege for us. We'd like to expand the scope of poetry and bring to the general reader exceptionally well-written books that engage our emotions and thoughts, that make us really happy, that challenge us in some ways, maybe even disturb us, and they provide some resonance to and insight for our own lives.
It's a wonderful perspective. And on a personal note, Ami, what first drew you to write poetry and then subsequently to become involved in the publishing aspect of it?
That's an interesting question. When I was a child, and I think most of us kind of went through that phase, you know, when we were teenagers, I wrote a lot of poetry, really bad poetry, you know, stuff that you copy. And I think that's the way you kind of learn. You copy poets whom you have read and you've admired. So I did that. And then I kind of left that whole poetry scene kind of thing and went back to doing what I was doing, studying, and then consequently getting married, getting a job, getting involved in raising the family and all that kind of thing. And I went into teaching. But later on in my life, because of certain family issues, I needed to stay home more and spend more time at home. So I decided to go back to writing, which was something I could do at my own pace, on my own time. And once I started doing that, I decided I would write a book. And the book sort of mushroomed into like a series, into a few books. And I found that sustaining that was very difficult because there is so much. It's huge. You're creating a world and you're trying to do so much. And it's a little too much to handle. So I thought, let me go back to some of my poems and see if I can start rewriting them or revise them or, you know, try and get some more idea of what, how to do something in a smaller, on a smaller canvas. So I went back to poetry, and I started reading, and for 2-3 years, all I did was I read poetry. And I used to always read a lot of poetry, but I went heavily into it. And before I knew it, I started writing some pieces, submitting them, and I was on a writing site where I met mentors who are working with us on Glasslar and Pyrene Fountain, and we all found a common interest of reviewing and writing poetry. And when I read the reviews, I realized that they were exceptionally gifted in being able to analyze poetry. And we had the similar interest. So at that point, I just said, hey, listen, why don't we start something of our own? And they all jumped at it. And before we knew it, we put up the first issue of Pyrene Fountain. And the rest is history.
Yes. And that book was What Hands Can Hold?
No, no, that came a little bit later. That wasn't a book. It was more of
a
journal.
Is that what Hands Can Hold evolved into?
Yes, that's it. Or rather, a lot of the poetry I wrote during those days evolved into What Hands Can Hold.
That's what I'm saying, exactly. Well, on that note, would you please honor me and our guests by reading one of your marvelous poems, the one in particular... If I'm pronouncing that right, Kaze, K-E-Z-E?
Kaze. That means wind in Japanese.
I'll be delighted
to read the poem.
Please.
So, Kaze, don't bother holding your breath as you tiptoe past the weeping willow. Her sleeping hands can't capture you anyway. One hand is tucked under the kimono you softly blew open last night. The other is tangled in her long black hair. Go quickly then, faithless one. Like the wind, you kiss many mouths and keep moving on.
Beautiful, wonderful word waving, my friend.
Thank you.
And to get back to Pyrene Fountain and Glass Lyre, I have my own opinions about what makes your publications different, but I wanted to ask what your opinion is. And not saying that it stands apart or alone on its own and different, but there are differences, and I think you've sort of kind of described it in a very good way about your philosophy and the way you went into this and what you want to accomplish. But can you sort of elaborate about what does make it different personally?
Are you talking about Pyrene Fountain?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can just give you an example. In Pyrene Fountain, when we started off, to our great surprise, many well-known and widely published authors sent us submissions, and many of these authors had pushcart prizes, some of them Pulitzer prizes, all kind of amazing credits to their bios and resumes and everything. So that was wonderful. But what really made me happy was that we were able to publish people who just started writing poetry. In fact, we got a submission from this young boy. He had just, graduated school, and he writes us a letter saying, "This is my very first submission. I have never submitted before. I'm not sure if I'm doing this correctly, but if you accept one of my poems, you will be my very first publication." And I said, you know, if there is a way we can get one of his poems in, it's going to make my day. I just loved the idea that we have this one person who is just starting out, his very first publication. And then we have these people who have published all over and written 10, 20 books, and they're so well known. So for me, it's like this wonderful little watering hole where all of us can come together in peace, and a place that we shed all our prior preconceptions, all the places we come from, and we're together just celebrating poetry. And
what a beautiful way to say that, Kenny. I love that, celebrating poverty. That's what it should be, removing it from the realm. It seems to you and I, Ami, have talked about this on a number of occasions, how poetry seems to have been relegated to the darker corners of the room. And I just am such, I am endeared to you in ways that fault me to express adequately about bringing poetry where it belongs into the middle of the room, under the sparkling chandelier, and not necessarily relegated back to academia. So I want to thank you.
What
a personal love as a writer and a poet, first and foremost. I want to thank you for that personally.
Oh, I tell you, that's so beautiful. And I am so indebted to all the wonderful, wonderful authors who have shared their work with us over all these years. We've managed to make beautiful issues together with their work. And then more recently, the anthology we put together, we had more than 500 people whom we've published so far. And of that, we selected 70 poets that I felt really, really that Mark, Lark, and I had a very difficult time choosing from, because they were all so good. And it's very thrilling to see that together, all those wonderful poems. To me, that really is a celebration of life, of everything that we do, of everything we read, of everything we think and that we are.
So well said. I think you and I both agree about the issue of the acceptance of reading fees. Could you just tell me and our listeners your feeling about that?
Yes, well, the thing is that when it comes to reading fees, some of the people have to, unfortunately, charge them, and some people do not. In our case, we do not have any kind of university funding, any kind of donations, any kind of grants. So we have to pretty much depend on our book sales. And in terms of reading fees, we do charge reading fees. They are combined reading fees and a prize fee. So we have what is called the Kitara Book Prize, the winning, this is for Glasslar Press, the Kitara Book Prize. And it is, the winner gets a check for $500, a medal, and a certificate. So when a submitter sends in their reading fee, that covers the Glasslar Press annual prize. And the reading fees are $15 for chapbooks and $25 for full-length manuscripts. So when people buy a book from our press or a copy of our journal, Pyrene's Fountain, they support the press. And we send out a big thanks to all the people who have already done so.
I don't yet, because an independent publisher does not have, you know, these giant budgets and some venture capitalist in the background just, just bringing money to you in a wheelbarrow. It really truly is. And this is a reason, one of the major reasons that I have so much respect for indie publishers and are so supportive of them and trying to always, you know, in my own social networks to just let people, you know, be aware of them. Because it truly, in my opinion, is a labor of love. It is not, we're not going to get rich.
No, that's for sure.
No, I mean, that lightning may strike, you know, in the bottle, but it really is, I think there's no other precipitant than just, as you said so beautifully earlier, to just share it, to share this with the world and give an opportunity to someone who perhaps may never have an opportunity to have their work professionally published, to be able to hold it in their own book.
Yes, yes. To have it selected from a whole, a slew of other manuscripts, to have it picked out, shows that it's already reached a certain level of acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be able to put it out there and have other people read what you've written, that's the most beautiful thing for any writer, I think. And as a publisher, it's exciting for me to be part of the birth process. And when I say publisher, I mean collectively my whole staff, all my staff, my wonderful, fabulous staff.
And I love that metaphor birth process, because it begins with the author, then the writer, and then to you, you know, taking that and continue the birthing process. It really does. It is viscerally felt by all of us. I know that.
Yes.
I mean, what to you makes a great poem and a memorable poem? I mean, in other words, what is it about a particular poem that stands the test of time, you know, whose lines are often widely quoted, like of Robert Frost or Edgar Allan Poe?
Yeah, you know, that's such a difficult question to answer, and it is certainly a very important one, because I think editors and publishers spend a lot of time thinking about that. What is it about this poem that we really like, and why are we picking it over others? And then the same thing can be transferred to, the same kind of feeling can be transferred to books. Why is it that this book, you know, is, why are we taking this over other books? And I think the for me, I mean, I think every editor has a different vision and would probably have a different answer, but for me, I think when I read a poem, if I read the poem and it sort of gets under my skin, it makes me feel something, it makes me sit up, it makes me start listening to its musicality, it starts making me feel a little disturbed, or it, you know, knocks at my mind, makes me think about something, then I know it's a poem that I'm going to return to. And I think the greatest test for a poem is its re-readability. If I keep reading a poem over and over and I still love it, or I love it even more, or I find it interesting, I know this poem is forever. If I read a poem once and I forget it...
I think that's definitely worth repeating, re-re-reading. I like that. I like the way you phrase that. I agree with you. You find yourself drawn back to it. It stays with you. You're right, the
exactly.
resonance. And you
exactly.
feel the need, you've got to go back and just read it again. And then you capture things in it you didn't discover before. And to me, that's the same process. I agree with you that it's a discovery. It's a journey with that poem. You discover
what
you're saying, but you also discover things in you and why they resonate that you may have not discovered.
That is so true. That is so true. For me, I mean, I think that every poem, every book, every story to me is a miracle, because we start with a blank page and somehow or the other we put these little scratching symbols on that page, little units of speech that become living language. And those words become sentences, the sentences become paragraphs or stanzas, and somehow that all becomes either a poem or a story. It's such an intimate act to walk in the words of a writer's imagination, his heart, his soul, or her feelings. And when you do that, your own perceptions and your own memories kind of flow and intermingle with what the author is saying. So the whole process is really very beautiful, it's mysterious, and it's just magic. It's pure magic.
See, I agree so much. It in a way is it's taking the intangible, the ephemeral, and making it. You can hold it. I mean, you hold these things within you. They feel physical. Sticking an idea and putting it into a physical manifestation, because again, you feel it. You physically feel it. And
yes,
on that note, Ami, would you please read another of your beautifully word-weaved poems? One of my favorites, Violin Concerto.
Oh, absolutely. Okay.
Sure.
Violin Concerto. How smoothly the strains of Paganini flow into the heart as the bow pulls a rippling swell from the strings in each passing. Power runs up, shifting the weight of lyric, a flourish of ornamentation. Who knew the curves of polished maple could yield such voluptuous sound?
That is just gorgeous. That is truly, again, a
tap. Thank you.
breathing. Lovely. Melissa also is joining us, as we said earlier, in a spectacular and phenomenal poet. We actually edit each other's work back and forth, and it's always so important for a writer, and I can't stress this enough, to work with an editor, someone who knows your voice, clearly hears it, and will be constructive, and will never tell you what you want to hear, but what you must hear, what you need to hear. Melissa,
yes,
would you please, I know we talked about you asking Ami your own question, would you please ask your question of her now?
Sure, I'd love to, and I'm so grateful that you let me ask it right after she read her poem, because, Ami, I want to tell you that was beautiful.
Oh, thank you, Melissa.
Sound.
It's such a pleasure. Such a pleasure hearing your voice.
Oh, thank you. Well, what I've been thinking about the whole time I've been listening to you talk in this wonderful interview is that you are such an amazing supporter of other people's work. And we see that through your publishing and through just all the things you do to encourage and promote and support other people. And I'm just wondering how you balance that with your own creative work, and if it ever feels like, I mean, I sort of get the feeling that for you it's all kind of the same thing, because it seems to me that your goal is to, you know, to get this beauty out into the world, but I would love to hear your perspective on that and how that all works together for you.
Sure. I think that you're going to understand this very, very easily because you're a mother. And I'm a mother, and I think to a large extent what we do as editors, publishers, you know, producers of shows and stuff like that, to me that's a lot like what I do as a mother. You're handling so many different things in life. You're taking care of your children, you're taking care of the kitchen, you're taking care of, you know, so many different things, the social aspect, the physical, the emotional, the psychological aspect. So in a sense, you're taking those skills and transferring them to a work setting. And for me, I have all these different things. I have the journal, I have the press, I have all my staff that I interact with and, you know, give assignments to and check on and make sure everybody's right on target and the deadlines are being met. And I'm trying to also promote outside of our company to make sure people know about us, to promote our authors. So in some ways, I'm doing exactly what a mother would do. And a mother will sort of say, okay, you know, let me feed my family, then I'll take care of myself. And that's, I'm sure you do the same thing. A lot of people do the same thing. That doesn't mean that you're sacrificing your own work. It just means that it might sometimes sit on the back burner. So when I started, it's almost 4 years since I published What Hands Can Hold. And shortly after that, I was going to publish my second book, which actually revolves and focuses on my Indian heritage and my love for music. I combined the love for music with little scenes and vignettes from India. And I've been wanting to write that book and put it together in a format where it's ready to be published, and it focuses heavily on ragas, which are Indian modes very similar to our key signatures. And I have written maybe 3/4 of it, but I haven't quite come to the point where I'm ready and say, okay, this can now go out for submissions to publishers. And you're right, to some extent, you know, our own work will take a back seat. But I always have that belief that if you are a writer, your work will have its own energy. And at some point or the other, it's going to be ready to come out and be seen or be heard and be published. So I know that I will do it. When I'm going to do it, I'm not sure. Whenever I have time between doing all my other jobs, sometimes I wake up especially early and I'll do it. If I'm in a doctor's waiting room, I'll pull out one of my poems and start working on it. So I think if you really have the drive, the interest, and the passion, you will go ahead and take care of your work.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing that you'll write in the doctor's office. That tells me that you just have this ability to just really be creative whenever you want. It sounds like you don't have to sort of meditate first or get yourself in a zone or anything. You can just say, oh, I've got 15 minutes, I'll work on a poem. That's wonderful.
You know, I think we have to kind of do that when we have very, very, very busy lives. You know, there are days when we have deadlines and someone's calling me and saying, I don't have a bio for this author. You know, this thing isn't properly proofread, or this is missing this, and we're all scrounging, running around, trying to look for stuff, you know, finding a lost file. So there's all this kind of stuff going on. So you have to create those moments for yourself and say, okay, even if I have 15 minutes, I'm just going to do some work. because then if you don't do that, then it just kind of builds up. And those days turn into weeks, and weeks turn into months, and before you know it, you haven't written a word, and that's not good.
Well, that's such an inspiration, because I love your analogy about mothering, and I think it's really perfect and beautiful. But also, we both know there's a difference between having 15 minutes and throwing in a load of laundry and having 15 minutes and creating something, right?
Very true, very true. So I mean, Right.
But it's inspiring to me, though, because in a sense what you're saying is, yes, there is a difference between those two things, but really, no, you can't let there be. You have to be able to sort of write on command if you want to write in a busy life. And I think that's wonderful. That's how we should be. Because I think a lot of people feel that they need to have huge blocks of time, or, you know, all these things that we come up with in order to procrastinate and put it off. And to hear you say, no, 15 minutes to the doctor's office.
Well, I think that would be lovely. Yeah, I know. That large block of time sounds so attractive and sounds beautiful, and I wish I could find that. I would be the first person to put on some beautiful music and, you know, get into the zone and just write. But I find that life doesn't always work that way. So if it doesn't work for you, then you work around it. That's what I found for myself.
Opportunity, Ami, will have to really know what it's like for the birthing process. And once again, I go back to that wonderful analogy. It's true. It's just the gestation period can be a matter of a few minutes, or it could be a matter of years till that whatever is those words are that are dancing in your head and congeal, and obviously you find yourself dashing to it. It's true. I know Melissa knows the story. When I wrote Down to the Boats, I literally wrote it washing my hands at the sink. It was there complete. And I had hurried to dry my hands, and I think they were still dripping when I dashed over to the keyboard and punched them out, and it was basically done. I'll let it back, and I think change a couple of words. So it's just, it's a process that's inexplicable. I mean, how can you really explain what is it? I mean, what are we born this way? Are we, as I said to Melissa often as well, I mean, I feel like all writers are born with a pen in their hand. But we're always writing, and we take those moments. It just seems to be at times they're a little more less inopportune. Generally for me, in the shower or in the other places in the bathroom, it's like, okay, I'm going to have to wait on that. Like,
no, but
I guess that's why they make digital recordings. But
yeah, I think you're making...
Ask Ami, of all of my writers, my friends, and especially my fellow poets, what is it about writing? And again, particularly poetry, that's you could say, truly shaped your life. How has it changed you and affected you?
I think the way that I look at things. You know, I think when you're a writer, especially a poet, you tend to notice every little detail. You slow down. You start listening, because poetry is such a compressed form. It's so tiny that every word has to carry its weight. And therefore, you really want to focus very heavily on everything that goes into the poem. Since you do that, you're slowing yourself down. You're really zooming in, you're focusing. And you tend to start doing that in your own life. You start slowing down. You look at every little detail. If you go out, I found that once I started writing, I was really enjoying going on trips and watching the scenery. I always loved nature. Who doesn't? But I was looking at it in a different way. When I'm looking at people talk, I'm looking at their expressions. That's an observational thing. But also psychologically, I think you kind of change inside. You start thinking of what people are feeling. And once you start doing that, you yourself become more sensitive to them.
That's true. And for my own, for myself, I find what it's done, and I think you said basically the same thing, is I seem to be much more in the moment. As the more that I write and the more that I just involve myself in that process, whatever I'm doing, regardless, even I don't think we ever stop writing. We're always writing all the time, sleeping, waking, it doesn't matter. But I find whatever moment I'm in that moment. I'm living that moment to the fullest. I'm in life, I'm as deeply in life as I could possibly be. And you're right, I agree. It carries over in whatever you're doing. It could be something as just, as such casual, it's so pedestrian, as just doing a little shopping. It's just, I'll notice other people in the aisle, and I'll overhear a conversation as I walk by. And for that little moment, I know the word sounds a bit cliche, but it is magical. My life's become more magical.
Yes, I think you're fully engaged in life. And I think that's it's a wonderful place to be. You know, I have never, ever been bored. Well, I can't imagine any writer being bored. Because if you're somewhere and you feel like, oh, there is nothing to do, then like you said, you're writing in your head. You don't even need a pen and a paper. You don't need an iPad. You don't need a computer. You're just writing. That's what you do.
Well, we're getting close to the end of the interview, and thank you so much for joining me. What a delightful time I've had, and as always, I always learn so much from other writers. And also giving our listeners a perspective of Pyrenees and Glass Lyre, publishing process, what's involved in that. Thanks so much for sharing that. I will want to ask you about what upcoming projects you have, but before we do that and we end the show, Ami, would you read what I consider to be, I would say, my favorite poem of yours, Pen?
Absolutely, and I think Pen worked very well with your show because your show is called The Right Step, and this is about the pen, which is an integral writing instrument for us, and the writing process. So I'll read this.
I'd have planned it that way, yep.
Okay, wonderful. Good planning.
Thank you.
Inside this bone burns marrow fire. It cannot be extinguished, only spent. A shadow dizzied by tabula rasa wraps around the reticent voice. As fingers curl around the barrel, a swirling dance of lyrics crams the mind. From somewhere comes a shift, pressing you into your own skin. Delirium thins the ink, the fever recedes, and just for that moment there is clarity before the flowers explode, and finally that high, that sense of satisfaction in the joyful ache of shoulder blades that waits until the purpled blood is dry.
Just stunning. I have reread that.
Thanks.
Going back to rereading, I reread that poem, I don't know, a few dozen times, and each time I draw more from it. Please,
thank
I know
you,
publishing is important, it's integral. I thank you as a fellow poet to continue to do that because these are just wonderful publications. If you have not had an opportunity to go over to the websites, which Melissa's been so kind to post in the chat room, but if you haven't been in the chat room, I did want to say that you can go to these respective websites, but I'm going to say that after I ask you, Ami, what's next on your plate for Pyrenees and for Glass Lyre and for yourself personally and professionally? What's on the horizon?
Oh, sure. So we're going to be at the AWP in Seattle, And we're going to be hosting a reading for Glass Lyre Prayers and Pirine's Fountain on Friday, February 28th at 6 to 8 p.m. So anyone who's there would love to see you. We're also planning a huge Glass Lyre Press launch event on April 24th in Glenview, Illinois, and I'll have more information forthcoming on all social media, plus starting an open mic reading series locally, which is an exciting prospect for us because then we'll have a lot of poetry, we'll have poets, we'll be able to spread some interest locally and create a forum for writers and artists. This will involve be sponsored by Glass Lyre Press and Pirine's Fountain. We do have 5 books on our agenda for this year with Glass Lyre Press, some really nice titles. And Pirine's Fountain actually is going to be starting out as a print issue this year. We are hoping to keep some online presence for all our readers. We have a wonderful reader base, and we would still like to keep, to be available to them. So Catherine is looking into that, and I definitely want to thank my wonderful staff, each one of them. They're all just superlative. Mark McKay, Lark Vernon Timmons, Catherine Hirschler, Steve Asmussen, Elizabeth Nichols, Candace Sloan, Royce Hamill, Paul Kim, and our freelance artists, Tracy McQueen, Melinda Hipple, Call Elite, all of them, thank you so much for making every day full of adventure, fun, and joy for me.
That's wonderful, and I'm going to actually express the websites. If you want to find out more about AmiKay, you want to go to www.amikay.com, AmiKay. Glass Lyre Press is glasslyrepress, Glass Lyre Press, and also Pirine's Fountain is www.pirinesfountain, pirinesfountain.com. She's also on Facebook. Ami, I cannot thank you enough for being my guest tonight. It's always wonderful to do the shows and be able to speak with other writers and do these interviews, but to have a poet and a publisher together is truly the proverbial icing on the cake, and it's been wonderful. And Melissa, thank you so much for your assistance as well. Always appreciate it. And keep writing, everyone. Submit your work to Glass Lyre and Pirine's Fountain. Be happy. Stay in the moment. And thank you, Ami.
Thank you, Jeff. You've been such a fabulous host. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been an honor speaking with you and Melissa. That was really the icing on the cake, speaking with you. So thank you. And most of all, thanks so much for your support and encouragement. We're always thrilled to have you in our lives.
Thank you again. Good
thank
night,
you
everyone.
Both thank
you both as well. Right up with RJ Jeffries. And as I said earlier, and say it again, stay in the moment. It can be magical.
Indeed.